Backyard Green Films is proud to present this episode of Agriculture with your host, Alara Bowman. Alara and her husband, Rick, travel throughout the land in their teardrop trailer that they have nicknamed Maggie, bringing you stories about their travels and the people they meet. They visit farmers, ranchers, and just about anyone who loves putting their hands in the dirt or their feet in stirrups. For the past 3 years, they have been filming a documentary about heritage breed animals entitled The Holstein Dilemma, Heritage Breeds, and the Need for Biodiversity. In those travels, they have gotten to meet some very interesting people. Here's one of those interviews.
Hi, I'm Alara. Welcome back to our podcast. One of the things we've been talking about in our documentary is the use of animals we raise in agriculture. Most things don't stay around in the long run if they don't have a useful purpose, and many of our agricultural animals are raised for food. If we do use them for food, though, what's our responsibility with regard to how they live and how they die, and as to how we use the products they produce? Rick and I have gone through an evolution in our eating habits over the last 5 years, and one of the decisions that we have come to about eating meat is that while we're comfortable doing it, it's only if the animals are raised in a humane fashion. We want to respect the value of the life that we're taking and recognize what it takes to get the products to us that appear on our plates. I don't know if you've ever looked into the general process, but like anything that requires larger scale production, the whole process can be done very well, very badly, or somewhere in between. We don't want to get into the badly part of things. That's definitely been covered, but we do want to bring you an interview we did with a man that feels strongly about respecting the lives of the animals we use for meat production. His name is Adam Danforth. If you go to his website to look him up, you'll see that he's a James Beard Award-winning author of 2 books on slaughtering and butchering livestock, an educator, and a passionate advocate for responsibility in our meat production and consumption. Adam is a rock star in the world of butchery. We had this accentuated to us one day walking into our local farm-to-table butchery here in San Diego called The Hart and Trotter. Don't go there if you have pastrami restraint issues, by the way. Anyway, we were talking to the guys in there, and we mentioned that our next interview was going to be with Adam Danforth. Immediately, this caused a flurry with one of the guys, Brian, who asked us excitedly if we thought Adam might sign his books, of which Brian had both. And yes, there are butchery groupies, and apparently Adam Danforth is the object of awe in his field. And yes, he did gladly sign Brian's very well-read books. Back to Adam. He's a board member of the Good Meat Project, the Chef's Collaborative, and the Butcher's Manifesto. If you've ever had an unusual cut of meat, it's due to people like Adam. He teaches ways to not only make the end of the animal's life as humane as we possibly can, but also to value them by using every bit of the product they produce. When you consider that mankind's been eating meat since way, way back in our history, Adam's profession is one of the oldest on the planet. You would think that means that we have it down pat and that nothing new can be added to this concept. But in this day and age, food has become a product, and we've become separated from it in many ways. Adam aims to change that. We met up with him in Albuquerque, New Mexico. The Quivira Coalition Conference was there to discuss innovations in this both old and new way of looking at our food production system. Adam was holding workshops in the surrounding area, with restaurateurs showcasing new ways to prepare new types and cuts of meat. Rick had to do part of our Albuquerque adventure on his own, as I had commitments back home. We recorded the questions back in the studio as if I was there, and have put them in so you know what Rick asked off mic. We stayed away from most of the nitty-gritty in this interview, so the next half hour won't contain much of that part. But we hope you enjoy hearing from this very interesting man. Here is Adam Danforth. Please tell me your name and your title if you have one.
My name's Adam Danforth. I am a butcher and an educator, and I work on changing people's perceptions around meat through activism and experiential education with a couple different organizations, the Good Meat Project, Chef's Collaborative, and the Butcher's Manifesto.
How did you get started in this career?
The path to being a butcher was, a very unorthodox one, really, because, well, at the time, this was about 10 years ago, I worked in marketing and advertising in New York City. And And I, as much as I enjoyed the work that I was in, it wasn't providing me with the fulfillment that I got out of spending that much time focusing on that kind of industry. And I wanted to change careers, and I wanted to work on something that felt like it contributed to more of the change I wanted to see, and also creating community and things like that. And some of this is filled in a little bit with like the hindsight understanding of like why I was attracted to this food industry. I grew up in a household in which we always sat down for a family meal, and my mother cooked most of our meals, and I liked to help, and I was in the kitchen at a very young age, and it really instilled a love of sharing your concerns and your feelings around the people around you over food, and also just a love of like spending time in a kitchen working with my hands and creating things that I could share with people. So I missed a lot of the tactile qualities of producing things. I also had a background sort of in metalsmithing and some like this short stint with glass blowing and stuff like that. And then I went into digital stuff, which has nothing to show for it in a certain way. You're sort of like, you unplug something and 10 years of your work is suddenly sort of like dissipated. So there was a materialism that I was looking for as well. So I closed a company in New York City and then wanted to focus on food. And I wanted something that was going to be an area of food that would allow me to have a bit more control over my lifestyle as well than going into, let's say, a professional kitchen or a chef sort of path, career path. And meat attracted me. At the time, I was sort of a hobbyist in a way. I cured my own stuff a little bit and was smoking things and liked meat really a lot. At the time, I ironically ate far more meat than I actually eat now, but I was really interested in it. And as I became a little bit more informed about it, I also became to realize how vast of a topic it really is. And it was the most complicated area of food, I thought, between, you know, the animals that are alive and breeds and regional sort of like characteristics and husbandry, and then the aspect of slaughter being religious and controversial and political and historical, and then you have a carcass that is anatomical and scientific and biological and going through all these processes, and then as an ingredient, it's the most versatile ingredient we have in food. We can do things with meat that, you know, no, I mean, I love vegetables too, but like they just don't offer the breadth of options that meat really does offer. And so I felt like the complication of it as a subject matter would offer me such vastness that I would also never get bored. And I'm sure people who focus on any area of food begin to realize, or any area of the world, that like the more you know, the more you realize how little you know. And it's certainly been the case with meat. And so I decided to be like, oh, well, why don't I pursue meat? Why don't I maybe try to become a butcher? And I quickly came to realize that there was sort of like no modern way to become a butcher in America. That like the pathway to education didn't look like what we always think it looks like, which is an apprentice mentor model. You work underneath somebody. It's an ancient craft that, you know, has multi-generational history with it. And that's what I was looking for. I was looking for a mentor. And I connected a little bit with some local butchers. I was living in New York City at the time. And I just wasn't really finding the inroad that I thought. But there was another sort of like benefit of some timing that that ended up happening. And the timing itself ended up being that there was an experimental sort of extension program that was created in upstate New York at a school called SUNY Cobleskill. They have a USDA certified slaughterhouse on campus, and they were trying to figure out how to create a better labor force for meat processing. Well, because there's, you know, not only is there a dearth of qualified slaughterhouses to support local meat, but what further complicates it is a lack of really skilled resources to work in those slaughterhouses. You know, we treat processing and slaughtering like unskilled labor, even though it's really pretty much the sort of like linchpin to a continuity of quality between a farmer and a consumer. Everything can be changed and undone in a few moments within a slaughterhouse. So they were trying to create a more, trying to I guess, create a faster course for people into entry into meat processing through through front-loading their education in sort of a crash course model. And I heard about it through another butcher or butcher shop owner in New York City, Jake Dixon, who owns a place called Dixon's Farm Stand Meats, which is a really exceptional butcher shop in Chelsea Market. And he alerted me. I was contacting him because I want to be a butcher, blah, blah. And he alerted me to hearing about this program. So I moved to upstate New York. And I was totally out of my element. I mean, I was like a ex-advertising marketing person in New York City moving to upstate New York and starting to train in a slaughterhouse with other people who were also switching careers. But most of these people were like lived in upstate New York. They were also farmers or older than I was, and I was very, very much out of my element. And it was full of trepidation and fear and all these other things. But it was incredible. It was an incredible process. It was a process in which I was exposed to slaughter in a way that changed my whole conception of what it could look like.
Now, we've heard the term craft brewing, but we don't usually use that with regard to craft butchering. Tell me how that might be applicable, please.
Right. Well, and when you look at any of these handcrafts, whether it be farming or areas of food or blacksmithing or even like car mechanics or things like anything where it's really working with your hands, you're recognizing a deterioration of these sort of mentorships and this multi-generational knowledge that's at risk of being lost, especially in the next 10 to 15 years, as the last generation of multi-generational knowledge is getting to a point of age where either they're dying or they're getting too old to continue teaching or transferring that knowledge. So, you know, you see it with like lost languages, you know, around the world, the preservation of lost languages is also sort of an aspect of like finding these last people who speak a language and how do you capture that language? Well, really crafts have their own language and their own knowledge, and we're at the same risk of losing that knowledge in all areas of the world. I mean, butchery is different everywhere you go. The animal is the same in a sense. I mean, you have a static structure of, let's say, a pig. But like what you do with a pig everywhere in the world is totally different. To me, that's so fascinating because it's part of their culture. It's part of how they celebrate and connect and create community and underlies their food. And there's language around how they describe those things. And sometimes it's involved with like ceremonial traditions. Like there's so much information about it. To just like reinsert some other form of meat into that. And lose connection to that tradition means we're not just losing a way of creating a single dish. It means that we're losing so much of a culture. So it is really part of a language as well. And my pursuit in trying to preserve knowledge of butchery, especially in the next 10 to 15 years, is one that it's not just preserving a single craft. It's preserving really how much of this craft is central to how it cascades into all these other areas of people's communities, and that's just different everywhere, whether it's in Italy or Thailand or Germany or, you know, Georgia. I mean, it's really unique and endemic to every place that you go to. It's sort of like, what do you call this cut? How do you do this butchery? How do you do these things? So I don't want to lose that with some homogenized form of meat production in which everything is uniform, and the butcher becomes just sort of an intermediary salesman.
Now, we live in an age where we go to the store and we pick up a piece of prepackaged meat, and it's very sterile looking. But you believe in the concept of the whole animal butchering process. And would you please explain to us what whole animal butchery means to you?
Yeah, so whole animal butchery is a process in which you start with an entire carcass and you work through that carcass and end up producing marketable, sellable cuts from start to finish. When you're working with small animals like a chicken, a lot of people have seen a whole chicken before. They bought them at the supermarket. That's a form of whole animal butchery. You take the whole chicken, you come home, maybe you roast it whole, but maybe you don't. Maybe you break it down into six or eight pieces or whatever you may be cooking with. And that's a form of whole animal butchery. You start with the whole carcass and you end up with constituent parts that you end up utilizing for a recipe. Or if you're a butcher shop, then you end up putting it in a case. Maybe as like a chicken, you're going to sell breasts and you're going to sell legs. But in essence, you need to sell the whole thing because you started with the whole thing. Now, when you work into bigger animals, talking about sheep or goats or the pigs or, of course, beef, then obviously there's a lot more meat to contend with. But you still have the whole animal. And your commitment to putting meat in a case is that any meat in the case comes from a whole animal. And so if you're going to put meat in the case, then your responsibility is sort of a one-to-one equation in which I want the meat in my case to represent an animal and I want to sell that whole animal because I want to be responsible to make sure that none of it's wasted or as little as possible is wasted. And I'm supporting a farmer because the farmer raises one animal and kills one animal and then we have to sell one animal. So that connection between farmer and a whole animal shop is one in which there's continuity between, you know, the animals that are raised, killed, and sold through that market are, you know, that you can trace really quite easily. In most commercial meat environments these days, supermarkets and many other butcher shops that are not whole animal based, the model is different. The animals are raised wherever they're raised, good farms or not so good farms, depending. I mean, that's nothing to say about the farms, but they, you know, the animals are killed and then they're broken down remotely, so in some other location. And a lot of the reason for that is also a process of how they deal with post-mortem aging, like and a process called wet aging and allowing them to age animals and the parts of animals in bags and in distribution. So they kill, they then break down in more of a warehouse factory setting, usually high production sort of settings, and they figure out where, how to package cuts all together and then where to ship them really is what it ends up coming down to. So at a butcher shop then what you're receiving are boxes of pre-cut meat, maybe into large individual muscles or multi-muscle cuts or sometimes even into just portions, and it comes into a butcher shop and then the process of getting into a case is really more of one of opening a box, cutting open a bag, and either portioning those cuts or putting the portions that are already created into your case. So you don't really get the view of a whole animal in that context. You also don't know necessarily what animals those boxes of meat are coming from. And there's not as much traceability and there's not as much of the commitment to supporting, you know, smaller farms that are also around you often. So there's less of a waste model because you're just offloading the waste to somebody else's responsibility, you know, the larger corporation that's breaking down those animals and dealing with the logistics of getting it to you. But, you know, if you're buying, let's say, a tenderloin in a pork tenderloin in a meat case, there's only two pork tenderloins per pig. You know, if you go into a supermarket and you see 40 pork tenderloins in the case, like that's 20 different pigs. Where's all the other meat? It's probably not in that supermarket. It's probably somewhere else. It's been made into sausage, or it's been made into cosmetics, or it's been made into glue, or it's been made into all these other products that are created from it. And so the realities of like how much meat there is per animal and how we need to eat in order to support a whole animal is very much obfuscated by that process. So, you know, it used to all be whole animal because there was no other option. But then as boxed meat came around in really the 60s, 70s, and 80s, it changed that model. And the logistics of getting whole animals into butcher shops changed so dramatically that it didn't become feasible for a lot of people. So the butcher shops stayed open. Their model of how they received meat ended up changing. And thus, the education of how to cut meat also changed. And we lost the connection to understanding what a whole animal looks like and how we can break it down ourselves and understanding anatomy. So then there's been a resurgence. And at the time, 10 years ago, there was one shop that was really focusing on locally supported whole animal butchery, and that was this place, Marlowe & Daughters in Brooklyn. So, but that was the only one at the time. So I'd left a lucrative career in marketing to then pursue a job of which there were two positions in all of New York City.
You're a member of the Good Meat Project and the Chefs Collaborative and the Butcher's Manifesto, and you're a board member and an advocate for all the above. Please tell me why they correlate with each other.
The Good Meat Project and Chefs Collaborative and Butcher's Manifesto are all nonprofits that have these interesting sort of similar missions that overlap in ways in which I feel like my work to them complements all of the others. The Good Meat Project was started by a woman named Camis Davis, and it focuses on experiential education, which is also sort of central to my career as a means of changing consumer habits and perceptions around meat. We focus on three different silos, as we say, of the industry. We call them seeders, feeders, and eaters. The seeders, who are the ones who are growing food, in this case meat. The feeders are the ones who are processing and cutting and preparing food for people and presenting it to people. That would be chefs, butchers, slaughtermen, things like that. And then you have the eaters, who are the consumers. And all those people have different languages and different ways that we need to talk to them in order to reach them. And then at the same time, teaching them how to talk to each other in a far more successful way. You know, chefs have a hard time sometimes conveying to consumers why they need to do certain things in the restaurant. And then they also have a hard time conveying to farmers on how they need to source. And farmers have a hard time sometimes conveying to chefs, well, I can't give you 48 different lamb shanks for that event because I don't have that many and there's only four from every animal. And like, and how do we create those sort of languages so that we can all work and support each other in ways. So, and some of that, requires changing of business models and also just a flexibility. But it starts with creating a language that talks to each person with values that mean a lot to them. So that's the Good Meat Project. It's based in Portland, Oregon, but it's growing around the nation. And one of our main projects is also incubating meat collectives, which are localized experiential education organizations that then reach out to consumers through chefs and butchers and things like that. The Chefs Collaborative also focuses on incubating local networks, but they're networks of chefs. And we utilize chefs as a means of changing. We utilize chefs as a fulcrum for change within a community. Chefs have an incredible buying power in their establishments, and they also have really a lot of consumer respect. So we're utilizing not only their buying power to better support local agriculture, but then the sort of value of consumer viewpoints of who chefs are in a way of conveying why supporting local agriculture is important. And the way that they do that is through their menu. So our tagline is change menu, change lives. And by changing your menu and conveying to consumers better about why you're sourcing better, you're not only changing the lives of all the people you've supported, but you're also changing the lives of people who come eat through your establishment because they're going to see that message and hopefully they're going to take it back and share that with somebody else. So that's the Chefs Collaborative, and it's nationwide in America and has several different local networks. And the newest one actually is here in Albuquerque and Santa Fe. The third organization is the Butcher's Manifesto, which is an international network of butchers and meat professionals who are all striving to really preserve this craft of butchery and then imbue five different manifesto principles into it. One which is a responsibility of sourcing and husbandry of animals. Another one which is in conveying and infusing joy into our craft, not forgetting the fact that, like, this is fun. You can be really happy when you do this work and representing the joyful sort of expression of what our craft is. And also, you know, we want to drive the conversation about meat consumption in our various different areas that we are. And we also want to continue to offer educational inroads for butchery around the world, because that's one of the main bottlenecks to continue the craft is really entry points for people to learn about it. So the Butcher's Manifesto really wants to do that through entry points that are also all around the world and potentially in the future create what would be sort of like the butcher's passport, of which through apprenticeship you may enter into that network, let's say in Denver through, you know, Western Daughters Butcher Shop, or you may enter it in through Peru, or you may enter through Australia. But once you're in that network, maybe you spend 6 months somewhere and then you have access to another place that you're able to spend another 6 months, and your passport begins to get stamped and you begin to really understand sort of more of like not only a global view of butchery as a craft in general, but so many different practices and sort of cultural components that come to having that greater view of how to continue to be an advocate for the craft, but also to play your own role in defining your own style of butchery and helping to, you know, advance the mission of the organization itself. So all three of those sort of overlap in these interesting ways and help me to pursue my own goals, which have to do with experiential education and knowledge preservation. So,
of course, with our documentary, we wanted to ask Adam about heritage breeds and how they might connect with him. And he talked a little bit about that.
I've been fortunate in that, like, my butchery career has generally been focused on really great quality food and meat and farming and things like that. Like, I started with a romanticized idea that was totally ignorant around, like, what meat was. And then my introduction was through an interest of whole animal stuff. And I've had the opportunity to work with really amazing people. And so it was very early on that I was exposed to heritage breeds just through where that sort of interest was leading me. I mean, at the first butcher shop I worked at, you know, they really focused on supporting smaller farms that were in the region. And those smaller farms also had their own interests in supporting heritage breeds themselves. So just through that initial connection, I was being introduced to heritage breeds. How I was found by the publisher was from a demo I did in upstate New York at a really great farm called Kinderhook Farm. And they introduced me to, like, what sheep were they raising? Well, they were raising Dorper sheep. And then it was like an investigation into what their breed was and why they were raising. Actually, I think it was a Texel Dorper cross. And then, like, why they were raising this sheep. And then it was sort of like, and for me, I'm always, like, falling into research rabbit holes, like, all the time. And there's so many in the meat. And so I would start getting into looking at what are sheep breeds? What are the ancient sheep breeds? What are the domestic sheep breeds? Like, what are the commercial sheep breeds? Why, you know, what's the difference between a dairy and a fiber and a meat-developed one and all the... So, and soon I also ended up being connected to another organization called the Greenhorns, which is a young farming organization, nonprofit, and then also being connected to the Livestock Conservancy through the interest of also heritage breeds. So it was, you know, it was looking into... It was a very early introduction. That early on, I was being, I don't know, you could say indoctrinated in the heritage breeds, you know? And over the course of the years when I've had to work with, in workshops, that the source of the meat wasn't from a farm that I knew or somebody else knew or was a one that had really great practices. And there have been times in which you just work with meat that doesn't come from such great operations. It's just been, I mean, it's just like night and day. I mean, the difference of quality is just like shocking. And it's not just to say it's the breed. It's also so much of the practices on the farm and age and processing and all these other things. But so many people don't get to see that stark difference between, you know, a pig raised in an enclosed shed for its entire life that never really gets to see daylight, and a heritage breed pig that ends up finishing amongst the mass production of a natural forest in some sort of environment that's able to act out its normal behaviors and you know, dies on the farm. I mean, the difference of looking at those two meats is, side by side especially, is I think would almost in and of itself explain to anybody what the difference of quality between those two things were. And I think if two people saw that on a table at the same time, there's no way that they would choose the one that was raised in a shed, other than the fact that it costs so much less money, which is a whole nother complicated conversation about cost.
Yeah, I'd say most consumers look at the price first.
Right. Well, they also don't have a choice often in a supermarket or in a commercial meat, in like a commodity meat setting. They look at price. But they equate an aspect of price to sort of quality within the type of meat that's there. But it's all coming from mostly poor production models. I mean, there are very few retail environments that are offering, like, regenerative agriculture models, and that also have a transparency in the quality of their product.
If you liked our podcast, please subscribe. This is how we keep going. And please tell your friends to join us.
We want to thank Adam Danforth for visiting with us today. For more information about Adam, please visit his website at adamdanforth.com. Also, to find out more about some of the organizations that Adam is involved with, please visit thegoodmeatproject.org butchersmanifesto.com and chefscollaborative.org. Thanks again for listening. You have been listening to Agriculture with your host, Alera Bowman. Please tune in for more upcoming episodes from our travels. We'd also like to thank our producer, Michelle Council. I'm Rick Bowman, your behind-the-scenes editor. Until next time. This has been a presentation of Backyard Green Films Productions, all rights reserved, copyright 2019.